This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Gary Nordlinger is our guest. He's the president of Nordlinger Associates, a political and public affairs consulting firm that he founded in 1976. It provides political strategy, analysis, and communication strategies for hundreds of political officials, associations, labor unions, corporations in 23 countries on 6 continents. Gary, it's an honor to have you with us.
Pleasure to be with you, Coy.
Absolutely. Thank you for taking some time to join us. And you are at your office. Where are you exactly?
Well, actually, I am at home in Arlington, Virginia. My formal office is in Chevy Chase, Maryland.
Oh, there you go. Now, where are you from, Gary?
Actually, I grew up in the district. I'm a fifth-generation Washingtonian.
Really?
My great-grandfather moved up here after the Civil War from Macon, Georgia.
I didn't know your family was from Macon. How about that? My dad was born in Moultrie.
Well, there you go.
How about that? Yeah, South Georgia with the pine trees and the bugs.
So true.
And the paper mills. What a wonderful smell. Gary, give folks a little Gary Nordlinger 101. You've already started, I guess, but a little bit more of the emphasis on the particular trade that you are in.
I was one of the very first of the second generation political campaign consultants. I mean, before 1968, there really, you know, political consulting did not exist. And in fact, a man named Joe Napolitan invented the term, I think, in about 1969. And when I started in 1976, there were, you know, a handful of people that in both the Republican and Democratic parties. And, gee, by today, there are probably hundreds in each.
Yeah.
I mean, we're now well into the fourth, if not the fifth, generation of political campaign consultants.
And in your mind, because you've seen the arc of this development, what characterizes the biggest similarities and the biggest differences, you think, from this first generation that got started in the 60s and what's going on now?
Well, certainly, I can tell you, the challenge for me in 1976 was simply getting a candidate to use a campaign consultant. They all had their quote-unquote publicists back home. So it's not that we were competing so much against other campaign consultants for the business. We were just trying to convince people why they should be using someone who lived outside their home district.
Because they brought their PR man with them on the road.
Exactly right. And, you know, the classic cliche of all other, you know, 435 congressional districts are the same, mine is really special.
Gary, tell folks what you do for a candidate. I mean,
essentially, I'm on the communications side. So I get involved in the overall strategy of the campaign and then work very closely with the campaign team and the pollster in developing the campaign's message. And then I produce the advertising end of it, you know, the radio, the television.
And is that based on, would you do, for example, a couple of different approaches and then test them?
Oh, yeah. If you have the time and the budget, you really, well, first of all, you will always test your potential messages in your survey. I mean, forget budget. I mean, every candidate does that. And then if you have the time and the money, once you've refined the concepts and you test them in focus groups where you bring 8 or 10 people of the kind of demographic you're trying to reach into a room where you can actually show them various scripts and storyboards and find out what they like and don't like about the ad, both creatively and also substantively.
How does that work? Where do you find these people to just, and do you pay them and give them donuts or what do you do?
First of all, I don't do this myself. You know, that comes out of the survey research end of the campaign. But they're paid. And, you know, depending where you are in terms of the country, it can be anywhere from $50 or $150 to be there. And they come in for about an hour and a half and sit in a room with 7 or 8 other people, and there's a moderator who goes down a list of questions.
Now, I don't know if you've read Politics Lost, Joe Klein's new book.
No, I haven't.
And, well, I'll just get cut to the chase. Mm-hmm. At the end of the book, he basically lays the blame for everything that has gone wrong in politics in the last 50 years at your feet, at the feet of political consultants.
Well, he would not be the first to do that. What I would say, though, is campaign consultants, you know, if you think of independent variables and dependent variables, campaign consultants are the dependent variables. As you've had a decline of party loyalty, as you've had a decline of urban, you know, political machines controlling a majority of the vote, it's almost become a necessity that this profession was born. And the fact of the matter is that I believe 80% of the people worldwide, as you mentioned, I've now worked in a number of countries on all six continents that have more people than penguins. And I think about 80% of the electorate makes up its mind without much influence from a campaign, absent a big mistake by the campaign.
Gary Nordlinger is our guest, Nordlinger Associates. So this placing the blame on...
We can just pick that up. Bottom line is campaign consultants influence the 10 to 12% of the voters that just don't pay any attention to politics. They're going to vote, but, you know... They want their information handily condensed, and that is what a political consultant does, at least at my end of the business.
Gary.
You know, it's like USA Today. We give people their information in the forms that they will take it in.
Yeah. How does somebody win election these days? How do you win? When you sit down with a new candidate, somebody who's never run before, or maybe they're running for, pick an office, but what do you tell them when you look them right in the eye in that first meeting? What do you want them to know from you?
Well, so much of it is, are they willing to put, you know, just the sheer personal effort into this campaign? And will their families tolerate it? You know, are they willing to go out on knock on doors in the evening? Are they willing to spend their days raising money? And that is essentially what a candidate does.
Yeah, we spoke with Karen Kolber last week of Virginia Beach. I'm sure you know Karen, mm-hmm. and she was worked in a number of campaigns as well. And she was telling us about the good campaign memories and the bad campaign memories. And she said the bad campaign memories always have to do with a candidate who, for some reason or another, just doesn't want to win. They're just not a people person. They won't make the ask when it comes to money. And you just can't get that candidate out in the neighborhoods.
Well, yeah, you know, candidates tend to want to do the easy thing. They want to go to organized events where they're probably going to see, frankly, the same faces night after night. They don't want to actually go out and knock on the doors in the neighborhoods of key precincts. You know, they'll give you every excuse in the book. Well, people don't like to, you know, be disturbed in the evenings. And the same with raising money. I mean, somehow they just expect that the money will come in. And someone who's running for Congress basically is running to be 435th of one half of one third of the U.S. government. And you just can't declare your candidacy and expect the bucks to come rolling in.
Gary Nordlinger is our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now. You're welcome to join the conversation. We'd look forward to that at 977-1070. Gary, hang on with me. Let's take a very quick break. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. Gary Nordlinger of Nordlinger Associates is one of the top political consultants in the world, and he has worked with hundreds of political candidates. And Gary, can you tell us, before we get on to some of your reflections about some of what's going on in politics these days, but can you tell us a little bit about maybe some of your campaign memories, your most unforgettable campaign moments?
Well, they fall into two categories. One is really the true Norman Rockwell. I mean, you know, I sometimes, Josh, I've seen parts of, you know, the United States that even Norman Rockwell didn't dream about, you know, being out in really rural part of western Colorado, you know, with these big mesas in the background on a farm with farm equipment and the picnic, you know, where everyone in the county would bring, you know, something to eat and all the candidates would come and stand up on a picnic table and kind of make their pitch one way or the other. So, you know, they're very much the Norman Rockwell memories. And then they're, you know, are just some memories of absolute disbelief. The guy, you know, that tells you after he has been attacked that not only is the attack true, but there's even more to come. So, you know, it really falls into two categories.
Aren't they supposed to tell you all that stuff up front?
Oh, absolutely, because you want to get it out up front so you can test it in your polling and see what hurts and doesn't hurt and have a strategy ready.
Yeah, well, that's what they tell you, is to hang a lantern on your problem when you announce, right? Mm, right when you
exactly
get started.
Right.
So that
but, you know, some of these people just have a huge amnesia. I remember it was a statewide campaign in the Midwest, and our polling showed that our opponent's biggest vulnerability was she had habitually paid her property taxes late. And I said to my guy, well, how's your record? He said, absolutely perfect, but I had that funny feeling in my stomach. So we checked it, and it turned out his record was worse than hers.
Goodness. What do you do? How do you, because it's your job to...
We're able not to make that huge mistake, but you know, when people talk about negative campaigns, where they really work is when you can portray your opponent as a hypocrite. You know, if it's one thing none of us can stand, it's a hypocrite.
Yeah, yeah.
And so much about campaigning is not so much where the candidate stands on current issues, but whether we can trust that candidate to represent us on future issues.
Right, right. Gary, what's your take on the Senate race here in Virginia? What would you be telling if you were doing communications mm-hmm. for the Allen campaign right now, with all this talk about Jewish this, that, and N-word that?
I would have a two-pronged strategy if I was the Allen campaign. Number one, I would do a very aggressive push on what I have actually accomplished for the state of Virginia. And then you never want an election to be simply a referendum on past performance. So I would lay out, and here's what I'm going to work on for Virginia in the future. And then I would just try to pull everything out, you know, that my polling tells me is credible, and start attacking Webb.
And should we expect, I guess Bob Gibson of the Charlottesville Daily Progress was here in the last hour, and he said, you know, George Allen has so much money compared to Webb. It's not even close, the amount of money they have, and that we can look forward to a whole lot of nasty commercials about Webb coming out of the Allen campaign.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, 70-80% of the money, not only in Virginia, but nationwide, has yet to be spent this year. And, you know, you really want to save your money toward the end of the campaign when those, you know, low-information voters, that 10 to 12% I was talking about, actually start paying attention. So I think you can expect to see, you know, a lot of negatives from the Allen campaign against Webb. And Webb's going to have to do the same. You know, basically, Webb is asking people to say, hey, fire Allen. And, you know, I think the voter's a very fair-minded person, and you don't fire somebody without cause.
What was your take on the last presidential race, Kerry and Bush?
To me, the last presidential race, in many respects, was also a rerun of the one right before it, the 2000 race, where both Democratic candidates were bad messengers with bad messages. You know, in Al Gore's case, you had an election year, if I can borrow the phrase from Seinfeld, it was an election about nothing.
Yeah.
People were really happy. They thought the last 8 years was terrific. They, you know, thought they were doing well, that they were better than they were 4 and 8 years before, and they were optimistic about the future.
Big surplus.
That should have been a status quo election. Al Gore should have said, essentially, I'm not going to change anything. Instead, he proposed spending $800 billion to solve problems people did not feel they had, which allowed George Bush, who, if you think about it, was having real trouble getting any traction up through September. It allowed George Bush to turn it into a philosophy of government argument. Al Gore wants bureaucrats in Washington to decide who wins and loses. You know, I trust you. I want everyone to win, and I trust you to spend your own money wisely.
Yeah.
And that was a fatal mistake for Gore. In the Kerry campaign, you know, forgive me, but what was John Kerry's message?
I used to be, I'm a veteran. Was that it?
Well, that was fine. Until then, of course, you had the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth guys.
Yeah, and they took that down. Yeah.
And, you know, the only time I ever saw any passion out of John Kerry was just before Iowa, when he was reunited with his Vietnam buddies, you know, that had served on that boat with him. And he should have had those guys with him every day of the rest of that campaign.
Oh, you mean for what it did for him?
For what it did for him, exactly.
And what did it do for him? I mean, it just lifted him up, and did he?
You could see a human side to John Kerry instead of this you know, public policy computer. I have a theory that, you know, the self-made guys, the Ronald Reagans, the Bill Clintons, the ones that have the troubled childhoods, you know, pull themselves up to the bootstraps. They truly see people's problems and they feel the pain. The ones from, you know, elite backgrounds, the former President Bushes, the Al Gores, the John Kerrys, people born to privilege, finest educations money can buy, see people's problems and they think public policy. There's an absolute disconnect there.
That's really interesting. But what is it about the, you know, you look at Dukakis, Mondale, Gore, Kerry, Clinton is a bit of an anomaly when it comes to who Democrats choose to run for president.
If you look, since 1970, we've had two successful Democrats for the presidency, Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, and they both Well, there were two things in common. Number one, they were both running in relatively unhappy times. If you remember, in 76, it was Jimmy Carter who cooked up the misery index,
yep.
rate of inflation plus the rate of unemployment plus the interest rate. And then Bill Clinton, and I don't think there is any surprise, you know, that these were Southern guys who were fairly mainstream centrist candidates.
Gary Nordlinger is our guest of Nordlinger Associates, founded in 1976 and has worked on hundreds of political campaigns all across the world. Gary, thank you again for joining us this hour. We appreciate you making time for us.
Always a pleasure, Coy.
What is the difference? Because you've worked in a number of campaigns overseas. I mean, Africa, Europe, Asia. What is the, is there any one, like if somebody calls you and says, I need you in Africa, or I need you in Europe, what do you think of first when you leave the States to go work on a political campaign? What are the big differences?
Well, I mean, the process of message development is going to be similar everywhere, and the process of message delivery is different, you know, based on the technology, the laws, the sophistication of the country. That said, there's far more things we have in common. I have six or seven universal common denominators that never let us down. Number one, I believe that everybody wants a life that's a little easier for themselves and better for their children. So I think we vote as investors. You know, we may purchase goods as consumers, but we vote as investors. So, you know, people want to hear your pragmatic solutions to their problems, which leads me to point number two. People do not want ideology. They want pragmatic solutions to their problems. Number three, worldwide, a declining respect for elected officials and political parties. I think that has a lot to do with the availability of the mass media. I remember back in the 60s, friends would say to me, gee, this Vietnam War doesn't make any sense to me, but I just have to trust the president to make the right decisions, and he has the information. But now we see events on television unfold in real time along with our elected leaders. So, you know, we don't feel the need to give them that deference. So when I apply these various common denominators, you know, the campaigns become pretty simple in my mind.
Yeah. Now, you said there were six. Are there more?
There are more. But, you know, I hate to sort of bog down your conversation.
That's fine. What's your take on the race in 08 for president?
Gee, I think if the Republicans have the good sense to nominate McCain, it's all over. And on the Democratic side, if Hillary Clinton wants the nomination, she will get it.
Now, McCain is going to fight, from everything I know about the nominations, it's usually doesn't the fringe make the nomination?
No, I mean, that's certainly the stereotype in both parties, you know, and you don't get a Republican nomination unless you're, you know, pro-life. You don't get a Democratic nomination unless you're pro-choice, among others.
Yeah, they don't look to nominate moderates.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now,
but, you know, I mean, moderate on what? That's one of the big mistakes we make is that you really can't say someone's a liberal, a moderate, or conservative. It's more of a, well, conservative on what or a liberal on what? You know, there's so many issues now in that calculus.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Hey, Gary, what is it you think when folks are, you know, we're getting ready to go into October, and we're going to start seeing these ads are going to start flying like crazy, and next year we'll see a whole bunch for mm-hmm. the General Assembly races, and after that it'll be the presidential race. What is it that folks don't get or may not know about what really happens behind the scenes on a political campaign?
Well, number one, people will say to me, oh, I hate those political ads. You know, I would never base my decision to vote on that. And I'll say, well, you're absolutely right. You're one of the 8 in 10 who don't. Those ads are designed for the other 20% who do. I mean, as I've mentioned before, I think 10 to 12% of the electorate are low-information voters. They just don't have time or interest to sit down and follow the news closely and follow the campaign. So, you know, they're getting their decisions in the sound bites of an ad. Then there's another 8% that I think are just hyper-attentive, and they don't make their minds up until every single little piece of information's in there. In early voting states, when you survey people and say, why don't you early vote, the number one answer is, well, what if something comes out after I've cast my ballot? So, you know, it's not that people want to hear negative information. What they want is information they find useful in deciding how to vote. And on that note, they will welcome contrast between the two candidates.
Do you have a particular campaign that you look back on and you think, boy, you know, I'm so proud of myself?
No, I can think of several instances of people who I really don't think would have made it had it not been for, you know, decisions we had made either in responding to attacks or, you know, just the whole positioning of the candidate.
Take me back to a campaign where an attack came in and you got into the war room and there was initially this feeling of, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? And you completely turned it around.
Well, number one, what you want to do is try to anticipate the attacks to begin with. So, you know, in many cases, you can preempt those attacks. And then secondarily, there are occasions where, and this is where the negative research on your opponent is so important, so that when you get attacked, you have something to, you know, throw back at them. You know, yeah, what you say about me may be true, but did you know that blah, blah, blah? You know, there's several ways to respond to negatives. And when you can reveal your opponent to be a hypocrite, that's the best way of all. So, you know, I want to have a lot of research on my opponent so when we get attacked, you know, I can at least counterattack with something even stronger.
Yeah. To change gears here, you not only work for, you know, a political candidate, somebody who wants to get elected to office, but you've done some recent work for the New Jersey School Board or the
The New Jersey Education Association. I have actually been working within the education community now for 26 years. You know, groups like, for example, the Virginia Education Association.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've certainly done work with VEA over the years, and then I have literally been the New Jersey Education Association's ad agency since 1988.
Tell me what you do for them. Now, I've seen some of the spots that you've created for them, and I tell you, they make me want to jump up and write a check to the New Jersey, to any New Jersey school I can find.
Well, I would say from 1988 to 1994, basically what we did was advertising that basically appealed to NJEA members. You know, New Jersey is a very expensive state to advertise in because you're wedged between the New York and the Philadelphia media markets. So what advertising they did, I think, was primarily designed to make the teachers feel good about belonging to NJEA. And then one year, every year there's a conference of state communications directors within the NEA world. And there was a professor from Arizona State named Berliner who gave this wonderful talk. And the bottom line was that the overwhelming majority of public schools in the United States are doing a great job for the overwhelming majority of kids. And he took each of the statistics we had been hearing about, you know, SAT scores are dropping or there's no correlation between, you know, spending per student and results. My very favorite is, you know, how we lag on these international tests. And he just blew them all out of the water. And his point was, you people need to be out there getting the word out. And it's so funny how so much of life is being at the right place at the right time. As we were walking out of the room, I overheard the people in front of me. One says, man, we really need to get this word out. And the other said, yeah, but if we do, how can we say we need more money? And I literally took my right hand and hit myself against the forehead. And I said, Eureka, that's the problem. You know, that the NEA community for years had been making their message based on need. You know, we used to rank such and such in class size. Now we're this. If we don't do something soon, you know, Johnny and Susie can't read. And that because of all the right-wing hype, you know, since the Nation at Risk report in the early 80s, it dawned on me, hey, I wonder if people feel they've put billions in the schools, nothing seems to get better, so why not try things like vouchers? So NJEA, the New Jersey Education Association, let me test this concept in their polling, and what do you know, people feel better about investing in institutions they feel are successful than those they feel are in need. You know, in other words, the squeaky wheel does not get the grease when
right.
It comes to public finance.
You want to be part of a winning team.
Yeah, you want to put your money in the things you think are doing good jobs. It was shortly after Desert Storm, and I have to tell you, I felt a lot better about my defense dollar knowing the stuff worked.
Yeah, absolutely. So the decision then was to run what kind of spots?
Well, first of all, well, actually, believe it or not, the teachers themselves voted to tax themselves $50 a year for 2 years to fund a mass media program. So they increased their budget from $500,000 a year to $5 million a year. And what we did was came up with every statistic we could think of that showed the schools were working well. We tested those in statewide surveys. Then based on that, you know, we put scripts and storyboards together and tested possible messages in focus groups. And we learned so much from the focus groups. You know, you can't just talk about statistics. You've got to talk about values as well. We learned that public education is a reverse not in my backyard problem. People feel their own children's schools doing quite well. It's everyone else's schools that have problems. We discovered that they feel the problem is at the high school level. So we honed the campaign in on the statewide performance of the public high schools, you know, stressing the statistical performance of them in terms of graduation rates, percentages of advanced placement scores, you know, percentages of children continuing their education after graduation.
All the things that are working.
Right, and combined it with the values of hard work and personal responsibility.
And the result has been what?
Oh, the result's been very dramatic. It really changed the whole climate of public education in New Jersey. A couple of college textbooks have actually used this as a case study. But what has happened is, as the confidence in public education has increased, the politicians have stopped attacking the schools and have in turn embraced the schools to kind of bask in the glory. Christy Todd Whitman ended up being one of the best governors for public education that state had had by
a Republican.
Second term.
Yeah, a Republican.
A Republican, I might add.
Yeah, yeah.
And I have to say, NJEA is very pragmatic about supporting both Republicans and Democrats. But it really changed the climate, and there have been three distinct phases of the campaign. I mean, our slogan for the very first 2 or 3 years was, "The truth is, New Jersey's public schools work." You know, the cognitive dissonance was so great about, you know, feeling the schools weren't working.
Right, right.
Then once everyone thought the schools were working, we then changed it to New Jersey's public schools working, improving, achieving. Because you always want to show progress.
Right.
As I'd mentioned in the, you know, a few minutes ago, you never want a campaign to be just a referendum on past performance. And now the tagline is, because they, you know, want to bring it more, it's more now branding of the association. It's NJEA members making public schools great for every child. But, you know, it's still a sticking to the performance-driven campaign.
Yeah, yeah. It's fascinating. It really is a fascinating. I wonder it's a case study, because it really is fascinating how you've had that impact in New Jersey.
Well, thanks.
Gary Nordlinger, our guest this hour on Charlottesville Right Now of Nordlinger Associates, a consulting political and public affairs consulting firm since 1976. And Gary, of course, a graduate of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Gary, my friend, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Great. Coy, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. And this interview will be archived in its entirety at SevillePodcast.com.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SevillePodcast.com for more.